All right. Well, I want to introduce you guys to a friend of mine. Some of you already know her, but Easter morning. Well, first off, let me just say sorry for canceling our sunrise service. It did rain, but I feel like I canceled like Christmas morning. So we'll be back next year, I promise. And but anyway, such a special time, such a special rhythm for us as a church. But thank you for being with us here in person. It's so great to see such a packed house. Welcome, you guys. Easter is this moment that kind of is the very center of what we hold to when we think of the good news, when we think of the gospel. Easter is the pinnacle, the pivotal moment of it all. And today we think about the effect that it's had. It's had on our world. It's had on our life. Had on our future and our past and our present. And so we'd like to do a testimony on Easter, a chance for you to hear from one of our own. And today, you guys get to hear from one of my very favorite people. Her name is Liz Baldwin. I'm going to have her come up at this time. And if you don't know Liz, you're about to get to know her. But when I asked Liz to do this, her immediate response was, well, what is my title going to be? And she suggested associate pastor. I was like, that's a little quick for that, but we're going to see how she does. But anyways, just so glad that you guys get to hear from Liz today. So thanks, Liz.
Thanks, Jeff. Yep, I'm Liz. I think this is pretty comical that I'm the one on the microphone this morning. I would actually say I'm someone of very little faith, which is alarming as your new associate pastor, I know, but it's what we're working with. So, yeah. Excited to share my story, but I grew up in a divided household. I have the best mom ever, shout out Margie, and I grew up with a very angry father, and always walking on eggshells, and not really a safe space at home, and I think this really formed a lot of the anxiety I had, a lot of the fears I had growing up. It really made me feel unworthy and not really kind of enough, and so this is sort of the premise that I grew up with, and I never thought it was a problem. I just thought that was my MO and just how I was. When I was 19, went to college, picked up a Bible, and I remember after 2 years of reading it front to back, I shut the last page, and I remember thinking I will never, ever go back to being who I was before I picked this book up. And the words on the page just came alive. They spoke just drastically into my life, and the Lord gave me so much boldness, so much power. He gave me the spirit of not caring. He gave me this kind of carefree attitude, and he radically changed the DNA, I felt like, of who I was. And so I started operating very different. My favorite verse at the time was Proverbs 28:1. It says, the righteous are as bold as a lion. And I remember just thinking, like, I get to be an apex predator? Like, God in me gets to make me this, like, carefree, bold type person? Like, I've never, ever would have thought that would be my story. And so this was the trajectory that I set my faith out on, and I made a vow that I was never going to stop talking about Jesus because of how much he radically transformed my life. And the following 14 years, no one really warns you how hard faith is. So I'm sure a lot of you can relate to this, but I had so many up and down roller coaster moments in my faith over the following 14 years. I had so many years of silence where I didn't feel like I could hear the Lord speaking. Some of my closest best friends lost their faith and made me question mine. I saw my parents get divorced. I saw pastors at churches that I really loved have scandals and just really sad abuse stories. Moved to California, which is extremely progressive, you guys, compared to the Midwest. So many things. I started dating and fell in love with one of the best men I've ever met, and he didn't have faith, and so it made me wonder if I needed mine. So, gosh, just such a roller coaster of things, and I feel like it's probably relatable to a lot of what you guys have experienced with faith being a lot harder than I thought. And it was at this time that I was pretty angry, pretty frustrated with God, pretty, like, just felt like I couldn't, like, put him in a box and I couldn't figure him out as much as I used to when I was younger. And my friends and I started going to Church by the Sea. We stumbled upon it, and I immediately got pegged to be a youth leader, and I was like, nope, like, every time you go to a small church, they're desperate for volunteers. And I was like, this is a tale as old as time. I'm not doing that. But Chad, the youth pastor at the time, is very persistent. And so I called my best friend, Travis Noah, up, and I was like, yo, I think they need help. Like, We should maybe just go check it out. So I'm like so nervous. I'm frantically Googling like, what does Gen Z talk about? What is TikTok? I was like, Travis, we should probably dress cooler. Like, this is nerve-wracking. Forget being bold as a lion. I was like awkward as a baby deer. I was like, I'm very nervous around these school kids. But over the years of doing it, it's been 3 years now. This has absolutely radically changed my life. And I don't know how much you guys know about the youth group right now, but over the last couple of years, I feel like God has radically put his hand on these kids' lives. I've watched so many of them have very crazy stories similar to what happened to me when I was 19 and I read the Bible for the first time. I feel like they're coming alive and they're seeing a different way that they get to live. And in Zephaniah, it says that God quiets us with his love. And I feel like God radically quieted me with his love because of how much love I had for these kids and then how much I'm seeing like God come to them. And it just was this beautiful story of what he's done in my life and throughout the many roller coaster moments of trusting him and not trusting him and denying him in my own way and then coming back to him. It just all points to this cross and this beautiful story that I feel like we just need childlike faith, and it's so okay that I don't have it figured out. And I feel like God so kindly just pulls me back to him every time. And I think when I wonder what the cross means to me, it's just simply that he's my best friend up there and he has radically transformed my life. And it will look different in the future, I'm sure, than it does now. But I'm just so grateful. And I'm also really grateful to this church and to the youth kids that I'm looking out at that just means so much to me. So thank you and happy Easter.
Liz Baldwin, everybody. If you didn't know her, I'm so grateful. I am so grateful you got to hear from Liz because she has quietly over the last couple of years been a huge part of this church, of our young adult community here, and it's been such a blessing to the youth. It's funny because if you know Liz, you know how bold she is. So for her to tell her story and know that that wasn't always her story, but the way that God has worked in her life to bring her greatest gift really is her boldness and her fearlessness and who she is. And it's part of the reason I'm here on staff is because Liz is like, no, you're going to be the youth pastor. You need to be. So she has been just a huge blessing to me and to our church and to the youth. So Liz, thanks for sharing. That was beautiful. I'm going to read our passage this morning that Jeff's going to teach on. And I'm so excited for this morning's message. It was just beautiful earlier. So we're reading from Mark 16, verses 2 through 7. It reads, "Very early in the morning, on the first day of the week, they went to the tomb at sunrise. They were saying to one another, 'Who will roll away the stone from the entrance to the tomb for us?' Looking up, they noticed that the stone, which was very large, had been rolled away. When they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side. They were alarmed. 'Don't be alarmed,' he told them. 'You are looking for Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He is risen. He is not here. See the place where they put him. But go, tell his disciples and Peter, he is going ahead of you to Galilee. You will see him there, just as he told you.'" The word of the Lord.
Don't you just love Liz Baldwin? I was thinking Reverend Baldwin, but then she said we're going to workshop it, so we'll see. But thank you for that. And thank you, Travis. I just feel so grateful this morning. What an incredible morning. And what a wonderful day to celebrate. I do love it. I mean, this is where Patty and I do differ, is I'm more of a Christmas person than Easter, but she's all about Easter. But such a joyful day of celebration for us. Easter is this moment, this event that as we look back on, we see in its uniqueness, in its singularity, nothing like this has happened before, nothing like this will happen again. This one-time event that as we hold to it, we find all meaning deriving from. And I was talking to Travis earlier, and he mentioned a quote by Lewis that I love, where Lewis would say, with the resurrection, either it is of no importance, or if it's of the utmost importance. The last thing it could be is of some importance. Either this thing happened or it didn't. And if it did, it changes everything. And as we come to it today, I think it's so important for us to look at it with fresh eyes. That too often, I think, in our lives, we get jaded. It becomes familiar. The cross becomes jewelry, right? That the effect of it, the promise of it, can sort of lose its weight over time. And so we have this ritual, this rhythm of coming back to the cross and to Easter every year, because by it we orientate our lives. And I think sometimes as we're going through life, part of the reason that it loses its power is just the part of it's the familiarity, but part of it is our life just becomes sort of obsessed with the day-to-day mundane things. This is normal, but we probably don't spend our day asking, what is my purpose in life, or what happens to me after I die? That we're thinking more about what I'm going to have for dinner, or am I going to get a workout in this day, right? These kind of things. Do I like my job? What annoys me? What bothers me? But the truth is that life has this way of sort of abruptly confronting us at times. Whether it's a health scare or something dramatic that happens, something that jars us awake. And we realize that these questions are lurking beneath the surface, but not as deep as we might have thought. That all of us are wondering these things. All of us are processing these questions. And I think sometimes in life, we're running from them. I was listening to a podcast recently where the guy was talking about biohacking and keto and all these different things that promote health, saying that really he thinks deep down it's just death denialism. So interesting, right? If I could just stay healthy, maybe I'll live forever, or at least longer than you, right? That this is kind of the strategy that we've held on to. And we live our life with this sort of level of comfort that we can control this. And that works really well when you're young. It gets harder as you get older. But the truth is, it's a short-term strategy that ultimately, in the end, there's a reality that we all face. Questions that all of us have to grapple with. I think it was Nietzsche that said that in a world without God, we will worship health. And I think the truth is that we have. We've found it as something that we can control, something that we can cling to and hold on to. But like I said before, life has this way of disrupting us, pushing us back into these questions, reminding us of how fragile we are. And yet something even deeper than that, that stirs with longings, longings for beauty and for truth, for goodness. The writer Annie Dillard, if you haven't read her, she's a lot of fun, but she says the mind wants to live forever, or to learn a very good reason why not. The mind wants the world to return its love or its awareness. The mind wants to know all the world and all eternity, even God. The mind's sidekick, however, will settle for two eggs over easy. The dear stupid body is as easily satisfied as a spaniel, and incredibly, the simple spaniel can lure the brawling mind to its dish. It is everlastingly funny that the proud, metaphysically ambitious, clamoring mind will hush if you give it an egg. Is this true, though? Like, you know, we think about our lives, and we have all these deep longings, and then we're like, ooh, I'm kind of hungry. And in all of this, right, Easter is kind of this way of pulling us back, staring at this thing that matters so much, or doesn't matter at all. Either it's of no importance, or it's of the utmost importance. Every once in a while, we get confronted with this reality. And it's interesting, as Annie Dillard is writing this, she's in the midst of experiencing a solar eclipse, which turns out we're having in about a week from now. It's happening on my anniversary, and I'm trying to think, I wonder what that means. But, Dad, are you going to see the eclipse this year?
No.
We had talked about it. Oh, yeah. Well, this is kind of how I grew up, is we would follow these things around, and we'd go on trips and we would, you know, experience the eclipse. And how many of you have experienced a total eclipse? Okay, it's weird, right? Like, in one case, it's simple. Like, I could explain it to you if we have a candle and two oranges. You're like, here's what's going on, right? This is all there is to it. But the truth is, when you experience it, you feel really small. That the world, like, turns metal gray and then goes totally dark. That dogs, like, crawl under the cars and whine. It's so weird. Something about that kind of disruption shakes us. Doesn't surprise me that it's thought that maybe this is what occurred at the moment of the crucifixion. That the light went out and the ground shook. Apparently, the Emperor Louis of Bavaria in 840 simply died of fright on the spot when an eclipse occurred. It's just so interesting. And what might seem simple reminds us of things lurking deep down within us underneath that fear, questions that come up when we're confronted by reality greater than us, when what is familiar gets shattered. What it exposes in us is something deep and tender. Dillard writes this, "In the deeps are the violence and terror of which psychology has warned us. But if you ride these monsters deeper down, if you drop with them farther over the world's rim, you find that our sciences cannot locate or name the substrate, the ocean or matrix or ether that buoys the rest, that gives goodness its power for good and evil its powerful evil. The unified field, our complex and inexplicable caring for each other and for our life together here." Isn't that beautifully written? I mean, it's a little poetic, it's a little abstract in a sense, but it ties into something for all of us, underneath all of our lives and our day-to-day, underneath even our anxieties, lies this heart, this soul that craves, this will that longs to be known and seen and loved. So often when we run from the reality of these greater truths, what we miss is our deepest longings. Easter and the cross, it cuts through all the way down, rides those things down to our core. It speaks to the deepest places of our heart. When this moment occurred on Good Friday, when the ground shook and the sky went dark, the disciples fled in fear. It was the end of something. Their hopes were dashed. But on Easter morning, something happens. Something none of them expect. Not even the women that go to the tomb. In our passage today, we see them wandering in with blurry eyes filled with tears of despair. And some of you might have similar eyes this morning. Eyes where your hopes have been broken or your heart broken. Disappointments. And these women come to the tomb to prepare it with spices and find it's empty, which they didn't expect. That Jesus has not just resurrected, he's left. And I love this about Jesus. He's just always so low key. You would have thought he would be like triumphal entry number two, like everybody go get the palm fronds, let's do it right this time. And instead, he just walks out of there. He goes and finds his friends. And this thing has happened. This massive thing has occurred, and its effects are still being felt today. And yet he walks away from it just so calm and cool. I picture this like if you think of action movies where like the action hero is walking away and there's this explosion behind him and he just doesn't even turn around. Just keeps walking. It's like, boom, this thing has happened. And he's like on his way to the next thing. He's going to Galilee. This moment, this event that continues to reverberate throughout our world, throughout the cosmos. The theologian Darrell Johnson says this, "This is to set the present moment in all its uncertainty and confusion and upheaval in light of the unseen realities of the future." Talk about good news. The same Jesus who was crucified and was resurrected from a borrowed grave is coming again, and he's bringing with him a city. A city magnificent beyond what any of us have ever imagined. That's this truth. As we find ourselves in this present, clinging still in a world of uncertainty, clinging to what? To this hope. That hope has come into this world with this promise and this guarantee of victory. Death is conquered. All things shall be made new. And we let this story speak into our hearts, hearts that maybe think, like, I do believe, help my unbelief. We let this truth rest deep down within us and speak to those places in our hearts that are afraid or controlling and fearful. These deep words of reassurance. Death is not the last word. It's lost its sting. The resurrection is this proof that our world is not a closed system. Carl Sagan, you can remember, has that famous statement where he said, the cosmos is all there is, was, and ever will be. That's him not doing science, but doing philosophy that spills into his theology. But the truth is, the resurrection counters that claim. Says there's a power greater than all this, and it's come into this tiny little grave and is spreading throughout the cosmos. And we look at resurrection and we think, but that's impossible. And what the Easter story tells us is, no, it's not. It's just highly improbable. I'm guessing that none of you have witnessed a resurrection before. Some of you have probably witnessed a resuscitation, probably Owen right here, maybe, right? Like, people get resuscitated, but they don't get resurrected, right? 3 days, like, this body comes back to life. Something happens, this power from outside that, as it turns out, is the pivot point. It changes everything. That this world falling in decay, all of a sudden you see this shift. That now we're moving instead away from death towards life, new life. Do we have the eyes to see it? Another little sciencey thing, sorry about this, but back in like 2014, they built this a microwave telescope that was at the South Pole and was powerful enough that it could take an image, a microwave image of the galaxy, and what it exposed there, I should say somewhat controversially, because my dad's a physicist, so you can correct me, Dad, if I'm off on this, but it exposed these ripple effects from the Big Bang. Gravitational waves all of a sudden become visible. This black night sky, what you see is echoes from this creation moment. And I think the resurrection is something similar. Like, I think if we have the right lens, all of a sudden you're like, oh my gosh, the effects of this are everywhere. They're quieter, but they're deeply profound. Changes like what we heard in Liz's testimony, where things shift, things broken are made whole, things imperfect are made beautiful. This to me is one of the most convincing things, this empty tomb. Sure, there's this empty tomb, but then there's this ripple effect that takes place. It's not like Jesus was the first one who claimed to be Messiah. There were dozens that had. They came and claimed to be the Savior. They were going to turn this thing around, and then they died, and that was the end of that. And you see this historically over and over and over until this time. And this time it doesn't. He is killed, but something changes, that these lives, these cowards, all of a sudden are radically converted. Cowards become martyrs. Self-righteous become servants. The proud become humble. Persecutors become missionaries. Roman oppressors become converts. Like, something radically changes in people's lives. The effect of this moment. We talked about this the other day, that this plague hits at that time. And one of the things that created this total fire to go within the church was that the church stayed in the midst of the plague and cared for the people who are sick. Sometimes to their own demise. People stared at this hope, trying to wrap their minds around it. Who would do this? Well, people that had seen and touched and felt that death was not the final answer. That Jesus had risen, and not just that, but had brought with him grace and mercy and forgiveness. Frederick Buechner writes this, he rose. A few saw him briefly and talked to him. If it's true, there's nothing left to say. If it's not true, there's nothing left to say. For believers and unbelievers both, life has never been the same again. For some, neither has death. What is left now is the emptiness. There are those who, like Magdalene, will never stop searching until they find his face. And Mary comes to this temple. It's one of the greatest evidences for the testimony of this empty tomb. It's funny that it comes first from women, which there was an ancient Greek historian who said, this is why we don't believe the gospel is true, because a bunch of women were the ones who brought the message. And we know that women can't be trusted. They're hysterical. Interesting, right? And you go, it's not like the writers of these Gospels didn't know that fact. Why would they say something that would probably lead to such skepticism? Because it was true. He did. He appeared to women. And in the Gospel of Mark, in the chapter preceding this, they're named three times. Which tells us what? That if you look at that within the genre of the day, this is not folk literature. It's not some magical story being told. It's biography. The women are named three times because he's saying it's a footnote. Go ask them. They were probably still alive. Same thing in Corinthians. Paul's like, here's the people that saw him in this order, and many of them are still alive. Go ask them what they saw. And Mary comes in tears to the tomb and finds it empty, but not totally empty. There's an angel there, or two in some accounts. And this angel is there with a message. He's waiting in case anybody shows up. They should have all shown up, right? Because Jesus said this was going to happen. He's like, if you tear down this temple, in 3 days I'm going to rebuild it. It's necessary for me to die, but in 3 days I'll raise again. So you would have thought at least the scared disciples would be like, well, it's been 3 days. Maybe we should go look, right? And they don't. Not even the women here. They come to the tomb and they find a messenger there, an angel who's waiting. And these two verses are so profound. He says, don't be alarmed. You're looking for Jesus of Nazareth who was crucified. He is risen. He is risen indeed. He's not here. See the place where they put him. But go tell his disciples and Peter. He's going ahead of you to Galilee. You will see him there, just as he told you, right? Like, duh. Like, he did say this, you guys. No, I don't think it was sarcastic. But he's going, look, the tomb is empty. Jesus is on the move. An empty tomb, a missing body. And part of what I like about this is I think we can look back and think, oh, well, back in that day, they just believed this kind of stuff. And they didn't. They didn't believe it. Jesus told them and they didn't believe it. This idea of resurrection, it just wasn't on their map. It wasn't on their radar until all of a sudden they're confronted with this empty tomb. He's not here. And these disciples, these women, these followers of Jesus, they let this truth confront their worldview. They let it change their minds. This is not what they expected. And the angel says, tell the disciples and Peter. Which to me, I think, this is like the gut punch of this story. Now you would think that he's saying, tell the disciples and Peter that they owe Jesus an apology. Because they acted like a bunch of cowards. They betrayed him. They fled. Especially Peter. The guy who boasted and bragged that he'd die for Jesus. The guy folds in the courtyard when a little girl asks him, don't you know Jesus? And he says, I never knew the man. And Jesus comes out with such grace, such compassion that he's going, go tell my disciples that I'm risen. And you could see that message reaching the disciples and Peter going, you guys just go. He said disciples, which means I'm probably out, right? So he goes, oh, and Peter by name. Peter, the biggest screw up. Peter, the one who this whole thing was going to be built on. Who failed. And Jesus is like, no, that's how I build this kingdom. The most broken are the ones that are going to lead. The ones who have just had their whole pride shattered are the ones who in humility are going to be the servants that lift this thing up. And I'm thinking about as I read that, I think, like, tell the disciples and tell Jeff too. Right? Because it's for each one of you, you can put your name there because I guarantee you've like let him down and not always held true and did those things that you regret or those mistakes that you made. You're like, oh, if I could just erase that thing, right? then I would be qualified. And he comes out and he goes, tell Jeff, it's empty. We're going to build this thing. Each one of us come to it with our brokenness and receive grace and mercy that we don't deserve. And he steps out of this tomb like a prisoner leaving jail. I picture him like leaving his grave clothes, like that orange jumpsuit that you wear. The sentence is paid. Not just the one that he bore, but ours, right? You can imagine Jesus walking out of the tomb and like letting the sun hit him for the first time and taking in that breath of air like, okay, now it's really finished. He says, don't be alarmed. The angel says, go. Tim Keller says, we're free from the world and free for the world. That our eyes are open to this greater truth, that death is not the end, that we are deeply loved. All those longings in our hearts are ultimately going to be realized. And then we're set free now to live with this wild abandon, to pour our hearts and our energy, every bit of grace that we've received, we pour out into the world. I was reminded this week of a quote from Johnny Erickson Tada. Thanks for this, Mom. That we've read this book when I was a kid, and her story is that as a young girl she dove into like a shallow pool or something like that and was a quadriplegic, and growing up she was in a wheelchair, and so every time she was in an Episcopalian church, every time they would serve communion, they would ask people to kneel, and she couldn't, and it would break her heart. But she wrote this. She says, I can't wait for that day. Because when I get my glorified body, the first thing I'm going to do with my resurrected legs is to fall down on grateful, glorified knees. I'll once again have the chance to say with Psalm 95:6, come, let us bow down and worship. Let us kneel before the Lord, our Maker. She says, you know, I realize that in heaven, I'll have the chance then to jump and dance and walk and run. It will be my privilege. A new body that can move will be a blessing for a job well done on earth. But I think that kneeling very still on bended knees, glorified knees, I think when I get to heaven, that'll be my sacrifice of praise. To not move when I will be able to move will be my one last chance to show the Lord how thankful I really am. Isn't that beautiful? I think that's the response to Easter. Like you go, all this gets repaired. And it's not this like ethereal sort of new life. It's physical. It's tangible. Jesus comes out of the grave and it's physical. Touch me. Put your hand in my wounds. That this world is worth dying for and saving. That this world, that each of us will not just live beyond, but physically, tangibly. That we'll still be able to worship God with our bodies. But rather than dance and sing, first we kneel. And this is this way that we enter into this mystery with humility and dependence. None of us has earned this. We enter with our hearts laid low. I love that song that we sang today, that he's turned what? Graves into gardens. And it reminds me of George Herbert, the poet, said, death used to be an executioner, but the gospel has made him just a gardener. What a wonderful thing for us to hold on this Easter. That not only is this hope secure for the future, not only is our shame and guilt made clean in our past, but we are brought alive in the present to experience and savor the goodness of life and to give it away. I think this day, hopefully for you, is filled with beautiful gifts of family and connection and food and all these things. It's for this that Jesus died as well. Every good and perfect gift is from him. That this life of resurrection that we live in should be practiced every day and it should be filled with joy. Kevin Kelly, who I've quoted for you in the past, has this statement on his website that says, over the long term, the future is decided by optimists. And that should be us. That is what resurrection means. optimism and joy that can look suffering in the face, that doesn't deny it or pretend it's not there, but follows it all the way down to the depths, to the level of the heart. I think Luther said, if he knew he was going to die tomorrow, what would he do? He said, I'd plant an apple tree. This idea of like life is restored. And I know Greg's been leading our men's group through Romans 8, and you're like, wow, that's a long time for one chapter, but you're like the layer after layer after layer of truth found in that. And Paul, it's Paul like grappling with the reality of this changes everything. And so I just want to read some snippets of this over us today. We're going to have a chance to respond in a moment in song. But listen to these words, these promises from Scripture. We know all things work together for the good of those who love God, who are called according to his purpose. For those he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son, so he would be the firstborn among many brothers and sisters. And those he predestined, he also called. Those he called, he also justified. Those he justified, he also glorified. What then are we to say about these things? If God is for us, who is against us? He did not even spare his own Son, but gave him up for us all. How will he not also with him grant us everything? Christ Jesus is the one who died, but even more has been raised. He also is at the right hand of God and intercedes for us. Who can separate us from the love of Christ? No. In all these things, we're more than conquerors through him who loved us. For I'm persuaded that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor rulers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor any other created thing will be able to separate us from the love of God that's in Christ Jesus our Lord. Amen. Just as the women discovered this empty tomb, we too are called to ponder the significance of this moment. The resurrection of Jesus isn't merely a historical occurrence. It's a reality that continues to reverberate through time, shaping our understanding of life and death. It invites us to embrace the hope and grace that Easter brings us, recognizing our failures and doubts are met with forgiveness and love. Like Peter, we may stumble, but we're never beyond the reach of God's redeeming grace. Ultimately, Easter proclaims a message of victory over death and a promise of new life. It challenges us to live with faith and optimism, trusting in the unfailing love of God. As we celebrate Easter, may we be inspired to live fully, to love deeply, knowing that nothing can separate us from this love.